I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, a proposed bill in Washington state seems to be about keeping Donald Trump's name off the 2024 ballot. But if you read between the lines, the intentions are actually much more sinister. Also,
parents are obviously frustrated that they weren't consulted or given enough time to process with their own kids. What are your thoughts on that?
A local school superintendent defends the gender identity lesson taught to fourth graders. Plus, another poll shows Dave Reichert leading Bob Ferguson in the race for governor. And aliens gone wild at a mall in Miami. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Happy Thursday to all of you. We're excited here on the show because we're adding a new feature tomorrow. It's interesting because I do my opinion, obviously, if you haven't figured that out by now. This is an opinion show. But we really want to, because mainstream media and I think legacy media is dwindling by the day. I mean, there's fewer and fewer dedicated journalists to covering what's happening in Olympia. And we're at the beginning of a very important legislative session. So for the next 8 weeks on Friday mornings in your inbox, you will find a brief show that summarizes all the important things that happened in the legislative session during the week. So you can bite it off really easy before the weekend, be caught up on everything that happened, that the lawmakers are doing, both the good, the bad, and the ugly, and be on your way. And I think it'll be very good. So look forward to bringing you that starting tomorrow and for the next 8 weeks of a short legislative session. All right, our top story today follows up on a story that you guys had a lot of comments about yesterday. Not a surprise, a story that angered me to my core. So there was this email sent out on the 7th in the evening, January 7th, to parents of fourth graders at Mar Vista Elementary in the Highline School District, basically saying, hey, there is a staff member who, prior to the holiday break, identified as Miss Angela, and when your kids come back to school tomorrow, they're going to be expected to refer to Miss Angela as Mr. Angel. And to prepare them for this sudden change in their young lives, we are going to use a book called It Feels Good to Be Yourself in order to illustrate issues around gender identity. And on the show yesterday, we played, this is just a YouTube of reading, this wasn't used in class, but it's a YouTube personality, I guess, reading part of this book, It Feels Good to Be Yourself.
This is Ruthie's friend, Alex. Alex is both a boy and a girl. When Alex was born, everyone thought Alex was a girl. But Alex is both boy and girl. This is Alex's gender identity.
Yeah, and the book goes on to suggest that it's got a picture of a baby, and it says, when you were born, someone looked at you and guessed what your gender was. It's just a guess, though. So, you know, it takes it from this issue of being, you know, a single staff member who decided to identify as a different gender and a different name, and, you know, whether you agree with it or not, trying to explain that to kids, to then indoctrinating them on gender ideology using a book that suggests that you can be two genders at the same time, or that doctors who are doctors and know when they look at a baby when it's born what gender it is are just simply guessing. And that you can decide at 4 or 5 years old later on, if you want, tell your parents that the doctor guessed wrong. So it just takes it into a whole nother realm. So our friend Jonathan Cho, Jonathan cracks me up. So Jonathan Cho, independent journalist, covers the issue of homelessness and other cultural and political issues for Discovery Institute. There happened to be last night a Highline School District meeting, and there were some community members who spoke up. I will say, and what Jonathan told us this morning, we were chatting with him just for background before we started the show today. He said there are a lot of parents who came but don't want to say anything, because they are so terrified about being vilified for speaking out against this particular lesson. And not just the lesson. As I stated on the show yesterday, the idea that you would tell parents this at 4 p.m. the day before they're going to come back, their kids are going to come back to school and get this lesson, gives parents no time to figure out how they're going to address this situation with their kids. And that's just not right. So anyway, Jonathan Cho went to this meeting, and he just, as he often does, just marched right up after the meeting to the superintendent and talked to him about it.
Parents are obviously frustrated that they weren't consulted or given enough time to process with their own kids. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's opportunity for us to think about how we can be better. Definitely we'll take some learning from this and think about what we can do differently.
So as of now, is this curriculum, though, still in play? Will it be used if another staff member decides to come out and transition?
This is identified as supplemental curriculum, so it's not per se curriculum that the district has adopted.
And will this book be used again in this district?
This time, I'm not going to have any comments.
Yeah, so I call that defending it, because this is something that's very clearly wrong, regardless of what aspect of this you look at. I mean, letting parents know the night before is wrong. Taking this issue with one staff member and turning it into a lesson on gender ideology that's just not biologically sound is wrong. And so for him to say, well, I have no comment, I mean, obviously parents are upset. Obviously this goes way too far. And I wish he had just acknowledged that. And then I'll just play this video, because that's why I say Jonathan Cho is just so funny. I love Jonathan. He does exceptional work. His tactics are sometimes unorthodox. I mean, he definitely gets in people's face. But he's up there chatting and obviously having a perfectly polite conversation with the superintendent when the district's communications lady comes up and tries to get him to stop.
Okay, I'll use this. Jonathan, thank you so much.
You? I'm Catherine.
Nice. I'm sorry you just interrupted my interview, but
sorry.
Dr. Duran, thank you so much for your time. Take care. What would you like to say? Anything?
I'm just trying to find out what it is you're needing.
I just asked the superintendent if he heard the comments loud and clear, and he just said so. What's the parents had to say?
Here, Jonathan. Thank you.
Can you please not touch me?
Sure.
Okay.
Can you please stop filming?
This is a public place, ma'am. Are you aware of the law?
I'm aware of the law, okay. But your question has been asked and answered.
Right, and I actually wasn't talking to you. So I was talking to the superintendent, so if you don't mind, could you please give me some space? Thank you.
Oh, Jonathan Cho. But, I mean, the media blockers don't like him, and I think one of the reasons, I mean, first of all, Jonathan's hands have been forced a little bit because he has publicly paid media people in various offices across the state who don't even give, they won't even respond to emails, they won't let him come into press conferences, and so he's sort of had to pivot and just go directly to the source. I mean, there is no way in the world he would have been able to have that face-to-face exchange with the superintendent who's paid by our tax dollars had he not just gone there and done it. You really think if he had gone through the proper channels and the media handlers, they would have let Jonathan Cho talk to the superintendent? Not a chance in the world. Jonathan was telling us this morning that media handler is a former TV journalist.
Yes.
I always
now that her expression at the end kind of makes more sense, where she's like, fine, I know your game.
Yeah. Well, but also I always laugh when my former colleagues in the media go into the PR flacky mode, mm-hmm. because there's been some exceptional journalists. I will not name names, but some really good, solid journalists in Seattle TV, especially, who have gone on to be government spokespeople, who have done a terrible job. And it's like they all of a sudden like changed overnight and forgot what their whole careers were about in trying mm-hmm. to inform the public. They're like, now I'm going to play block against the media for politicians and public officials.
I know
officials.
How you work, so I'm going to stop you.
Yeah, just ridiculous. But I'm glad Jonathan followed up on that. And I think one of the things that's really, really important here, this is another example of a story that we wouldn't have found out about had people not taken the time to send out emails to people like Jonathan Cho, to people like us, and let us know, like, hey, this is what's happening in our kids' school. I mean, when you think about this, these emails went out to the parents of one fourth grade class in one school district. And they sent it out to, and parents that got it sent it out to multiple news agencies because they want their voices heard. Now, maybe they're not quite ready to go on the record and come out publicly with their face and their name and put themselves out there, given, you know, how vicious people can be when you question any aspect of gender identity. But in order to actually stop this stuff from happening, that is really where we need to go. We need to have more parents like Alicia Perkins in the Olympia School District, who has really made it her mission to expose some of the things that's happening down there. You know, and she's been all over the news, national news, local news, despite the fact that she gets a lot of backlash for it. And she decided as a parent, as a private citizen, that she wasn't going to take it anymore. And to that vein, we have an awesome guest on Sundays with Subscribers this week, and I just got to play a clip. So the name Jennifer Seay will probably sound familiar to you because she made headlines back during the pandemic for speaking out about school closures. And she wasn't just any parent. She was a top executive at Levi Strauss Company. She was in line to be the next CEO, and she ended up resigning under pressure from them because she refused to stop speaking out about the danger that school closures would have for kids. So she's going to be joining us on Sundays with Subscribers, and a theme of our conversation is really trying to encourage other parents and other people to take a stand.
This sounds like really kind of rudimentary advice, but you have to do it. You can't wait for somebody else to do it. The alternative is much scarier than actually speaking up and suffering the repercussions, because the alternative is we no longer have free speech and we no longer live in a free society. And I really, you will find new friends. You will find a new cohort. You will be surprised how many people that you know are like, oh, I'm so glad you said that. I was thinking that too, but I was afraid. You will bring people out, and you know, I'm going to be at the Roanoke conference in a couple weeks. And this is what I want to talk about is taking that individual responsibility. Individuals do change things. You know, I was one person who wrote this book about abuse and gymnastics. I was a good gymnast. I was not a great gymnast. I actually started the whole thing, you know, everything of people coming forward and speaking out. And it brought not just Larry Nassar down, but USA Gymnastics. They had to install new leadership, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just one person. I have so many examples of this. We all have to take responsibility. We cannot wait for somebody else to do it. You know, I always tell people, this is what I told them a year ago, you know, at some schools across the country, parent-teacher conferences were still virtual a year ago. Complain.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, it's just these little things every single day. Don't wear the mask. You know, say you are demanding to have that parent-teacher conference in person. Whatever it is, whatever gets you going and activated, use your voice and start. And you will find people to join you. That is all I know how to do.
Yeah, and she, oh gosh, just such a fascinating conversation. I'll get to more in a second. But if you want to watch not only this episode of Sundays with Subscribers, but all of our exclusive subscriber episodes on Sundays where we have in-depth conversations on interesting issues, you can sign up for $5 a month, undividedpod.com. But she referenced it there. You know, not only did she come out in a big way and ultimately lose her job over speaking out about school closures, but more than 10 years ago, back in 2008, she was a former gymnast and she spoke out about some of the dark side of gymnastics for children. And at that time, she was with Levi still, and they had her back. And I think that shows, and then, you know, you fast forward, and they very clearly did not. And I think it shows the shift from certainly 2008 to present in the degradation of our quality of discourse, that you can't just have disagreement, and that companies are so quick to cave to the mob, so to speak, because she got a lot of attacks for speaking out about this side of gymnastics in 2008, but her company had her back every step of the way. Not so much when it came to school closures. And, you know, she's sort of an extreme example of taking the risk to put yourself out there, because when she refused to stop speaking out publicly about school closures, Levi basically said, okay, well, you know, we want you to maybe leave, and we'll give you $1 million severance but you have to sign a non-disclosure. So she wouldn't be able to talk about it. And she said no. She left $1 million on the table so she could continue to speak out about what was happening to kids during the pandemic. So I think that is an awesome example. As she mentioned there, she's going to be at the Roanoke Conference out in Ocean Shores at the end of the month. I'm also going to be there hosting a panel on the substance abuse crisis. And so there are still tickets available to Roanoke. You can find them online. We'll talk more about opportunities to go in the coming days. All right, coming up next, a brand new poll that we broke this morning on social media. We're going to talk about it today. Second poll in the governor's race, and the second poll to show Dave Reichert ahead of Bob Ferguson. We'll break down the data and the demographics of the people who participated. But first, our friend Wes Jones, we sell with Wes.com, wanted to come in and give us his assessment of the housing market for 2024.
Well, my expectation is that rates are going to come down. The Fed is telling us they are going to. It is an election year. I would have expected that to happen, even if the Fed wasn't talking about it. And if it wasn't interest rates, it'd be something else. It'd be tax credits, first-time tax credits, something, you know, something else, some other type of incentive to spark housing. Because, you know, come November, they're going to want people feeling good about the economy. And, you know, I listened to, you know, Zach Abraham, you know, one of your other guys, really smart dude. And, you know, he has concerns about the economy, you know, that are not going to be controllable. But what can you control? You can control housing to a certain degree. And if they can put pressure down on interest rates, allow more transactions to happen, it's going to make people feel better.
Yeah. So if you've been thinking about selling your home, but maybe the market just wasn't, you think, in the right spot in 2023, if the Fed follows through with those interest rate cuts, you're certainly going to have more demand. And so the prices of your home will go up. Sellwithwest.com, sellwithwest.com. Get in touch with them. The first thing he'll do is give you a free market analysis to talk about how your home is positioned. And he can also take you through some of their great programs to get your home ready for sale. Sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, our friends at Future 42 are out with a brand new poll in the governor's race. We are the first ones, as an ambassador to Future 42, I better be the first one to have access to it. And it is good news, again, for the Dave Reichert camp. I mean, when you really think about, and look, are polls the end-all be-all? No, we are almost a full year away from the 2024 election. But certainly when it comes to fundraising, when it comes to how a candidate is positioned, polls are very important. And also keep in mind that Bob Ferguson is in a fundraising blackout. And so polls like this at a time when he can't raise money, it's also interesting timing. So the poll from Future 42 shows Dave Reichert at 39%, and this is in a head-to-head contest when the other candidates in the race are not considered by the individuals who are surveyed. Reichert ahead 39% to Bob Ferguson's 35%. You'll remember that the first poll that came out in the governor's race, which was from a progressive polling institute, put Dave Reichert just 2 points ahead. So this certainly widens the gap a little bit, although it is still within the margin of error, which is plus or minus 5.5%. But I can't imagine that those are numbers that Bob Ferguson's camp is particularly excited with. I'll just say with their polling methods, they polled 500 Washington voters. They matched them up to demographics, so it was reflective of the state, and the polls were conducted between December 9th and December 13th. So obviously, there are more people in the race still than just Dave Reichert and Bob Ferguson. So when surveyed, including the other two leading candidates in the race, here's how things shook out. I will note 37% undecided. That's a huge chunk to be undecided, especially when you have two people with some pretty good name recognition. I want to meet the person who's undecided between Bob Ferguson and Dave Reichert. You know what I mean? Like, I want to meet that person. Although that could reflect someone who's undecided between, say, Semi Burden and Dave Reichert, who hasn't made up their mind yet. So that would still be reflective in there. So 27%, if you're looking at a four-way race, 27% for Dave Reichert, 28% for Bob Ferguson, just 5% for Semi Burden, 3% for Senator Mark Mullett, a moderate Democrat. Some other interesting information that I thought I'd share with you guys in detail, because it, you know, suburban voters are kind of considered like that's who you want to go after, right? Because they tend to be more apt to be swing voters, independent voters. So Dave Reichert, according to this poll, holds an advantage in suburban and rural areas. Bob Ferguson holds an advantage in urban areas. I don't think that's a particular surprise. But if you look at GOP voters right now, 75% say they would vote for Dave Reichert. 48% of independents, that's the key there, say they would vote for Dave Reichert versus just 26% of independents for Bob Ferguson. Not a surprise that only 5% of Democrats say they'd vote for Dave Reichert, so that's pretty low.
I'm not sure that that's going to be the case at the end, though.
What do you mean by that?
I've just been talking to a lot of friends who vote very Democrat, and even they have said they would vote for Trump if they had to at this point, because it's so bad.
Yeah. Well,
it's crazy.
I don't know. It's people say one thing behind closed doors, and then if they say something publicly, they're like, oh, I'm not going to say that. Okay, let's get back to this quick. So for urban voters and urban voters, only 29% say they would favor Dave Reichert. Suburban voters, 42%, back up one for me.
Oh, sorry.
Come on, Nicole. You're just really
moved on.
I'm just kidding. You had moved on. I had not moved on. Because I think one of the keys here is Dave Reichert is winning suburban women by quite a big margin, 41% to 25% for Bob Ferguson. And suburban women, I mean, there's a big chunk undecided there, 34%. But suburban women, these are the women who have in the past, you know, really
prioritize the issue of abortion access. And so maybe that's an indicator that Dave Reichert isn't turning them off as much as some would like you to believe. Okay, on favorability, and this will go outside the governor's race for just a moment. No one in politics in our state has particularly good favorability. I like to think that if my favorability was measured, it would be 100%. No? Why are you laughing?
I mean, it'd be close.
You disagree? Okay.
It'd be close.
So one thing I want you to pay attention to here, because I think it's interesting. So both Dave Reichert and Bob Ferguson essentially break even on favorability. But far fewer people know who Dave Reichert is, which I actually think is interesting. Because when you look at like the 19% who don't know who Bob Ferguson is, when people do know who he is, they don't like him. you know what I mean?
Right.
So it almost hurts Bob Ferguson because his, like, people know who he is, but they also don't like him at a much higher percent than Dave Reichert. I thought that was interesting. Democrats in the legislature with they're negative three, they're 3 points under on favorability. Governor Jay Inslee, 9 points under on favorability. Republicans in the Washington legislature, 22 points under on favorability.
That's a tough place to be, though, because they can't get much
done. They can't
done.
Do anything good, but they can't do anything bad. And it's also, I think, reflective of sort of national politics and sentiments around Republicans in Congress, perhaps. But it does put them in a pickle, because it's like, well, what do you mean we only 30% view us favorably and 52% are unfavorably? Like, we're in the minority. And so maybe people don't see them pushing through anything. And they're right. Like, well, what are they doing? Well, they can't do much, right? So anyway, interesting polling. I think this is going to be another good boost for Dave Reichert. I will also point out, you've got coming up remember Republicans are doing things different this year where they're having a nominating process. So it's the hope of the Washington State Republican Party that during their state convention, they will officially choose to back a candidate in the governor's race. Now, Semi Byrd is working very hard behind the scenes to try to get his people to be part of that selection process. And I also saw Dave Reichert put out something. It's fascinating, though, to see the amount of sort of, gosh, how do I put this? Social media chatter about Semi Byrd versus Dave Reichert. Not that social media is real life. But then to see Semi Byrd, but then you realize that's what it is, because Semi Byrd's campaign is broke. They have no money. And if you're as popular as social media leads me to believe, based on comments and people who come to your defense, I would think that you'd be bringing in more money and more small donations, but he's just not. And then also, you know, this is a second poll to show him polling very, very low. So it's just fascinating to watch sort of internally in the Republican Party, people who are like all in for Semi Byrd and I'm not saying polls are everything, but it's like, gosh, what if the state Republican Party, like in the people who go to the convention, they do endorse Semi Byrd?
That would be interesting. But I think that that's representative of a lot of things. I think the loudest get the most attention and they feel the biggest. And then you go to vote or you actually talk to people that are not involved in politics. And
yeah, but the people who are involved in politics are the ones making that decision. Oh, and Semi Byrd has gotten the endorsements of a lot of county Republican parties, right, including a couple days ago, Snohomish County, which right. To me, I'm like, okay, but let's say that he's the better candidate, which I just disagree with in terms of their ability to win, their experience to do the job. Mm-hmm. How does he run a campaign? He has no money. He's out of money.
Well, I mean, he assumes if he got the nomination,
that all that money would go to him. And the question is, would Dave Reichert drop out? Because honestly, both of them have waffled a little bit on that question. Semi Byrd made it clear to us in that interview, a month or two ago, that I have no doubt Semi Byrd would stay in, even if Dave Reichert gets the endorsement. The question is, would Dave Reichert do the same thing? So this whole endorsement process,
either way, that'd be terrible. I mean, it really would be terrible. It would absolutely take away the chances of winning at all for Republicans.
Well, I don't know. I disagree that, because then you'd look at splitting it. Would that put you in a position? Because Mark Mullett will stay in all the way through. I'm convinced of it. So would having two Republicans and two Democrats really put you in a position to split it enough where two Democrats move forward? I don't think so, because I think Dave Reichert would get a far bigger chunk. It's interesting. I think Republicans have backed themselves into a corner a little bit with the nominating process, the expectation that people will just accept it, which I think you're going to see candidates put their own personal ego ahead of beating Bob Ferguson, which is a very, very sad thing to see, but we'll see. A lot will play out in the coming weeks. Mm-hmm. Okay, in our segment, Unbelievable, there is a bill in Washington State that seems like it is trying to just keep Trump off the 2024 ballot, which is bad enough. But when you read between the lines, I think that the intentions here are far, far more sinister than they're letting on. We'll get to that coming up in our segment, Unbelievable. First, take the First Mark Challenge, people. I've been talking about it for almost a year now because Mike and I took the First Mark Challenge. We now have all of our insurance through First Mark. We got better insurance for the same price. And we have an experienced local company to handle all our insurance needs for us. And it's just awesome. And one of the reasons it's important right now to have an insurance broker on your side is because it's a weird time in the insurance industry. You know, they're not making the margins they want. And so they are more apt to drop you for even the smallest claim. Here's Dave Taylor, the CEO of First Mark.
We could have a client come to us today that maybe just had a comp loss. So like a windshield loss.
Sure.
Right? Just a little ding in your windshield. And they come in, and we don't have a carrier that will take them.
For a ding in their windshield.
Right, for a ding in the windshield, right? And this is changing, right? So we have some carriers that are starting to loosen up already. But it's just I'm just saying there's never been a better time to be a broker because you need multiple carriers to find solutions for your clients these days. You can't just have one carrier because they might not want your client.
Yeah, and if you don't have an insurance broker like First Mark, someone who works for you, not the insurance company, what's going to happen is you can't just call your insurance company and say, hey, here's what happened. Do you think it's worth filing a claim? No, they're going to go ahead and file a claim on it. And then if it's something minor that you shouldn't have filed a claim on because it's going to hurt you in the long run, you're going to be in a tough situation. But with First Mark, you call First Mark first. You talk to them and say, here's the situation. What do you advise that I do? And they're going to give you advice. And it's really, really critical to have an expert there to give you advice on that. So firstmarkinsurance.com. First Mark. Insurance.com, they work for you. Nicole's not impressed with my made-up jingles for all of our advertisers, which I actually think are kind of the same. Like, I have the same jingle.
It's the same go-to tune of a jingle.
And I just change it.
Maybe.
I don't know. Maybe I should be, you know the show Two and a Half Men?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Isn't he a jingle writer in it? Charlie Sheen? That's his job. He's a jingle writer. And he lives in this mansion in, I think, Santa Monica. So are you saying I could take my jingling skills and live in a mansion on a beach?
Well, if you enter this decade or this century, I guess, because I think those are the 80s, 70s style.
Interesting. You mean the decade you were born in?
80s, yes.
Okay, no, I'm just kidding.
Yes.
All right. Anyway, love you, Nicole. Okay, time to get serious because this is a very, very, very serious thing. There are, of course, efforts across the country from some Democrats to try to just plain old keep Donald Trump off the 2024 ballot. There is a similar effort underway right now in Washington State, but I worry that if it's successful, the implications will go far beyond Donald Trump. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unflippin' Believable. Great. So let's start with the bill itself, because I think that there's the bill and the language in the bill, and then there's a news story that talks to the bill's sponsor that, to me, speaks directly to her motivations. And when you combine the two of them, you understand how serious this is. So this is House Bill 2050. It is sponsored by Representative Christine Reeves. It reads thusly. No person shall be eligible for any state or federal office who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or an executive or judicial officer to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, unless Congress has voted by 2/3 of each house to remove this disability. It says this section shall be interpreted in conformity with the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution and with relevant court decisions interpreting that section. So that section of the 14th Amendment, remember, is what they used in Colorado, what they used in Maine in making a decision to remove Trump from the 2024 primary ballot there. Now, I think it's interesting that this bill also says it should be interpreted in court with relevant court decisions interpreting that section. So it leaves a little bit leeway, like, oh, if a court, you know, has it interpreted this way, because my reading of that section of the Constitution is that you would have to have actually been convicted of, I think, committing insurrection. And that's been the argument against what Colorado and Maine are doing, is like, okay, are you now judge, jury, and executioner? And even though Donald Trump has never been convicted of insurrection, you can just say, well, close enough, and remove him from the ballot. So if you get, according to this bill, some favorable rulings in court rulings, then you could say, well, this court has said that that would stand up. All right. But the bill goes further than that. Another section, Section 3 of this bill, House Bill 2050. The legislature may adopt a resolution by majority vote in each the House of Representatives and the Senate, requesting the Secretary of State to issue a determination regarding a candidate's eligibility for office. The resolution must clearly state the grounds on which the legislature believes the candidate is or may be ineligible, citing the relevant provision or provisions of law. The Secretary of State must, within 10 business days of the request, issue an order stating whether the candidate is disqualified from the office they are seeking. Furthermore, if the Secretary of State determines that the candidate is not disqualified, the legislature may override that determination by adopting a resolution with a two-thirds majority vote in each the House of Representatives and the Senate, stating that the candidate is disqualified from the office they are seeking. Think about that for a second. So here you have, you know, giving the legislature the power to ask the Secretary of State's office. You've got a political entity asking a political entity to make a determination about whether someone should be prohibited from being on the ballot. And even if the Secretary of State says no such cause exists, you could then have a supermajority in the House and Senate override that decision by the Secretary of State's office. Now, why is that problematic? You could think, well, supermajorities, that takes an awful lot of people to decide that this person is simply not qualified. I want to remind you of what the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party said her mission is. Her mission is to build supermajorities so they can, quote, clean up the Constitution. Remember that tweet? With supermajorities, we can clean up the Constitution. My goal for 2026. And in truth, if you have Democrats and Democratic control in the House and the Senate continue to grow and solidify as it has, and the state admission of the chair of the Democratic Party that they want supermajorities so they can clean up the Constitution, well, imagine a scenario given this bill where you have supermajorities in the House and the Senate, which is not out of the realm of possibility. Then you have a situation where they could put through any bill they want, which is dangerous enough, and that's really what we're dealing with right now. But you also, based on this bill, have a situation where regardless of what the actual rules are around whether someone qualifies for office, they could seek to have them taken off the ballot and override the decision of a Secretary of State with a supermajority. If you think this sounds conspiratorial, I'm just giving you the data and the figures that would allow them to do that and their own stated intentions. Now, I mentioned Representative Christine Reeves, and actually this bill was pointed out to me by our friend Matt Markovich, who's over at Cairo Radio, and he published a story on it today, the headline at mynorthwest.com, new legislation could bar Trump from Washington primary ballot. But listen closely to what Representative Christine Reeves told Cairo Radio. Quote, obviously, we have individuals who will be on the ballot this year that, in my personal opinion, have disqualified themselves from participating in our election process due to their involvement in insurrectionist behavior. The ultimate goal, she says, the ultimate goal is to ensure that not only Donald Trump, but anyone following him meets the requirements to be eligible to run for office. For too long, we've relied on the honor system when it comes to candidates on their eligibility. This is about ensuring that individuals genuinely meet those requirements, and that includes refraining from attempting to overthrow the government. So she is saying explicitly that in her personal opinion, there are people who are unqualified to be on the ballot, including Trump and anyone who follows him, and that if you have someone who's attempted to overthrow the government by their estimation, not by a court of law who's convicted them of it, But by the majority party's estimation, they will try to prevent the citizens of Washington State from being able to choose that person as a leader. Now, look, I don't like Donald Trump. I've never voted for Donald Trump. I, however, believe in the ability of Washingtonians and voters across this country to choose the person that they want to lead the country for themselves. Just because Donald Trump is on a ballot doesn't mean people are going to necessarily vote for him. But to get into this slippery slope of saying that someone who's never been convicted of a crime like insurrection or aiding and abetting the enemy, that you could have one political party dictate that 7.5 million people in Washington, 4.5 million voters are robbed of an opportunity to choose that person. That is dangerous stuff. That is really scary stuff. And it's by their own admission. I might be putting the pieces of the puzzle together, but when you take it all into consideration, you read the bill, you hear Representative Christine Reeves' explanation as to what the bill is about and her personal intention, and you combine that with Shasti Conrad's claim that the goal in 2026 is to get super majorities in the House and Senate. You've had increasingly strong one-party control of government in Washington State, certainly for the past 8 years, but really ticking up that way for the past 40 years. This is the master plan for them. And voters have been falling for it in the state hook, line, and sinker. And it should terrify everyone to have one party with that much control that can literally put itself in a position to pick and choose what names appear on the ballot. Unbelievably scary stuff. All right, before we get to Florida Report and a little alien encounter outside of Florida Mall that I've been to, or was it an alien encounter? First, I've been talking about my success on the Eastside weight loss clinic plan. You know, I'm trying to lose like 10 more pounds to get back to my like peak physical fitness, Nicole. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been adding in now because I dropped all that excess COVID weight, right?
Right.
And so I'm like, okay, now I got to tighten up a little bit and I want to get in my peak physical condition.
Right.
If I lose 10 more pounds, it's not out of the realm of possibility that I post a bikini pic.
Oh my.
I don't think I've ever done that.
Why are you looking at me like that? I don't think you will.
Why?
Because.
I'm too classy for that?
Yes.
Well, it'll be a classy, maybe a one piece.
Maybe you could do a little special bikini photo shoot.
How much our sponsors at Eastside would love that if I posted a bikini pic?
Yeah, that's true.
They'd be like, yes, please.
Wow.
Anyway, I get so carried away.
Yeah.
Yes. But anyway.
More listeners do it, and then maybe I'm
down 37 pounds on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, feeling great, and I just keep going and adding healthier and healthier habits to my life, like yoga and workout routines and all that stuff. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Their program is, I think, good for people who do well with structure because it is very structured for 60 days. They are going to teach you what to eat in the right portions for 60 days at a time to lose excess weight, and then they're going to teach you how to keep it off for life without following some sort of restrictive diet for the rest of your years on this planet. So if that sounds like something that might work for you, maybe you want to be posting bikini pictures come March or April. Who knows? Schedule a free 15-minute consultation at EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team can answer any questions that you have at the program. And for the record, you know, body positivity, as long as you're not clinically obese, because that's not body positive, I would post a bikini pic now.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not going to, but I would still
wear
a bikini to the beach. I'm not saying you have to be, I have to be in my peak physical condition to post a bikini pic.
I get what you're saying.
Do you? Okay.
I guess. I still don't think you'll do it. I don't think your husband will allow it.
Oh, wow. You think, oh, wow. What is this, 1950? That he won't allow it?
You value his opinion.
I do value his opinion. I do respect his opinion. Anyway, dipping outside Washington State, a couple national stories before we get to Florida Report. So we talked yesterday on the show, the day before, about, you know, a school closing down for kids to work remotely or to do school remotely because this 2,000 migrants had to use the school for shelter and just wild stuff. So in Massachusetts, the governor is asking residents to house migrants.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this stage, it's just a request. Kind of freaks me out. I mean, we have a constitutional amendment that won't let the government mandate the quartering of troops. but we don't have a constitutional amendment that says the government can't mandate the quartering of immigrants.
Right. If you have less people living in your house than you do bedrooms.
Yeah, I'll read this. Governor Healey asks residents to house migrant families amid growing shelter crisis. The state shelters are reaching capacity. Now the governor is asking residents to help by opening their doors. No one's going to do that. That was part of Governor Maura Healey's announcement, as she is also looking for help from the federal government. She said anywhere between 10 to 30 migrant families a day are coming into Massachusetts. There are 40 hotels across the state helping to house them, but the governor's pleading for help from the federal government as well as the residents. She says close to 5,600 families are currently housed in the state's emergency shelter system. That number is 80% higher than a year ago. The situation is so bad, the Healey administration is asking people to open their homes and businesses to help people in need.
That's Can you imagine? Happen. Are they taking on that liability? What if something happens? Right.
If something happens, then the government is putting itself up for a tremendous amount of liability. But wow. Also, even in the nation's second wokest city, Seattle, I think San Francisco is still the wokest. Even in the nation's second wokest city,
Oregon, we have us too.
But. All right. Second or third. We have, Nicole's just really on me today. We have a homelessness crisis. Do you see the Uber progressives and the Stop the Sweep crowd inviting them into their homes to sleep on their couches? No. And it's not going to happen in Massachusetts either. And none of these responses from any Democrats or anyone else who's been finally at least speaking up about how bad the crisis is, none of their responses get to the root of the problem. None of them are being more forceful against the Biden administration to actually cut off the flow of migrants. So that we don't end up in this situation. They're just like, oh, they want more money. Private citizens step up. Private businesses step up. You know, I'd be really curious to look into, Nicole, maybe you can Google it when we get into Florida Report here. But I'd be really curious how Massachusetts treated businesses during the pandemic. You know, have they always been good to small businesses when it came to pandemic closures and stuff like that? Or do they treat them like crap and now they want them to open up their doors and help house migrants? I wonder. Nicole will Google it. Okay, a follow-up to a story we talked about yesterday. Guys, I was so excited. I was thinking about sending my ashes to the moon one day. And there's supposed to be our first return to the moon's surface since 1972. And it was going to be for some research for NASA, but also the private companies that I had never even heard of this allow people to bring their ashes up to the moon and be on the moon's surface. Well, now it's been delayed until at least 2026. According to CNN, more delays for NASA's astronaut moonshots with crew landing off until 2026.
At least.
At least.
That's just quite the delay.
A lot of delays going on. You know, I didn't even... It says, safety is our top priority, said NASA Administrator Bill Nelson. The delays will give teams more time to work through challenges that they're having. So it seems like, and that's fine. Oh, I mean, you don't want to shoot into space until, you know, you've got everything in order.
Absolutely.
For sure.
I think we were talking about it earlier this week, and I think that just fuels some of the conspiracies that we've never been there, number one. And then...
Stop it, Nicole.
Stop I'm just saying, it just fuels them.
Only certain conspiracies are like allowed it. On this show.
I'm not saying I'm one of those people. Okay. But it fuels that, and then it's just a bummer.
Yeah. So, fuels it because, like, we were there in 72, and it's so many years later, and our technology is so much better, and we haven't even gone back.
But I will say that other countries have tried again in the last couple of years. They mentioned that other countries have tried and failed. Nobody's been able to get back there the last few years that they've tried. Anyway.
Huh. Okay. All right. No comment for now. Yesterday's conspiracy is today's mainstream news. Okay.
It's very hard to get there.
Oh, is it?
You know?
Breaking news from Nicole Thompson. It's very hard to get to the moon.
Very hard to get to the moon.
Not easy. Thank you for that contribution to the show today. All right. It's Thursday. That means it's time to check in on what's happening in the Sunshine State. And apparently there was an alien sighting in Miami. Let's get to it. Maybe.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, hello.
Hello.
Wonder how much longer your governor is going to be in the presidential race.
I don't know. He doesn't seem like an early quitter by any measure, so he might be taking it as far as he can.
I'm sure he will. He's in too deep. All right, so let's start with something I'm a little torn on, as I am with a lot of Florida things, where it's like the free state, but is it? free for some. And I'm sort of like, come on, Ron. So Florida lawmakers considering new laws that would limit children's use of social media.
Yeah, it would basically require kids to verify their age under the age of 16 for any social media like Instagram, TikTok. What are the other ones they got out there? I think there's some new one I don't know about.
Kids.
But Facebook, et cetera, which I'm with you on that. I don't really know how I feel. I don't have kids, so it's hard for me to have a pretty direct opinion on it. But when I do see some kids on social media, I'm just kind of like, aren't they a little young for that? Because it can be quite the disturbing, you know, way to not only waste your time, but also just exposure to things.
Yeah. And then one of the other things, HB3, it would require pornography websites verify visitors are under 18. How are you going to do that? I mean, there's like booze sites where it says, click here to say, yes, you're 18. But all that really does is it covers their ass, but it doesn't actually verify that someone's under or over 18. So I don't understand that. But with the social media platforms, I mean, I think it comes down to parenting. I think you just got to let parents parent and decide whether their kids should be on it or not. I get it that it's destructive, but in a state like Florida where it's like freedom and, you know, giving parents choice and stuff, it's like, well, you can't say you want them to have more control over their child's lives, but then keep restricting it in one direction.
It's true. And, you know, there's also like, I see in these younger generations, these apps being a great platform for these young kids starting businesses too. And I think that that's also like to take that away from kids who are using it to grow a business, or these kids that make those Taylor Swift bracelets and sell them and stuff like that. Like there's so many other ways to use the platform. And like you said, it should just come down to the parents' decision to let their kids use it or not.
Yeah, Nicole and I talked about a story yesterday that's sort of in a similar vein out of California. They're contemplating banning tackle football for kids under the age of 12. And I guess, you know, for that one, I'm like, because I have so many concussions, I'm like, I get it. I don't think kids are tackling that hard anyway. But it is also about if a parent wants to let their kid play, do you let them make that decision?
Yeah, I don't know. That one, there's so much science behind the dangers of tackle football that it's kind of like would be stupid to ignore it. But again, that does come down to a parent's choice to let their kid partake in something they know what could happen.
Yeah. And there's got to be reasonable guardrails. I get it. That's why we don't let 12-year-olds walk around with Glocks, right? You're not like, oh, parent can decide whether their kid can have a shotgun. No. So there has to be some reasonable guardrails as a society. But I think it's a constant debate and question. I'm not saying I have the answers, but about where those guardrails are and when it is in the realm of parents and when it needs to be in the realm of the government. Okay, yeah. Ron DeSantis is saying that they're going to be a sanctuary state for students fleeing anti-Semitism.
Yeah, he's asking university leaders to make it easier, to allow an easier route for any student from across the country who is fearful for their safety or their lives during all these pro-Hamas, anti-Semitic protests that seem to be happening kind of everywhere. And basically, those students would just have to fill out the proper paperwork, meet certain requirements, and they can have out-of-state tuition fees waived so that they can easily transfer their credits and themselves down to Florida. We are not free of anti-Semitism. I don't think you can escape that in any state. I think making a point to say that we're gonna allow you to come here and help you feel safe, that should come with other steps in regards to that to make sure that these campuses are safe from those same anti-Semitic protests that you see happening all over the place.
Yeah, and look, I one thing I do trust is for Ron DeSantis to speak out about it as governor if there are anti-Semitic actions on college campuses. It's something that did not happen in Washington State. You know, we had clearly anti-Semitic protests happening at the University of Washington. It's our governor's alma mater. He didn't say jack about it. So I think also having that messaging that, hey, we're not going to tolerate that on the campuses of our public colleges and universities is important. And I don't know why it's controversial. You know, I laughed at this CBS story trying to like dunk on DeSantis for this. Florida welcomes students fleeing campus anti-Semitism with little evidence that there's demand. It's like, okay, blue state governors do stuff for the optics all the time. And you don't see headlines like this. And so even if he's doing it to send a message, you're giving him complete, he's trying to make kids feel safe. And you're just like, absolutely crapping on it, for lack of a better phrase. Yeah. So it's interesting. I also think, I hate to say it like this, not that they're, how do I put this? Like, you can tell when I'm really struggling with how to say something. I would hate to see kids take advantage of it to say, I want out of state, I want in-state tuition in Florida. I was going to go there anyway. So I'm just going to say I'm, you know, scared of anti-Semitism in the college in my state or whatever it is. Okay. Yeah. The final one, you know me so well. You know I love a good alien story. So the internet is all a flutter because there are claims that there was this huge police response to a mall in Miami because there was an alien.
Yep. So there's videos all over the internet. It'd be pretty easy for you to find. But we have a very popular tourist destination just outside of the cruise port called Bayside Marketplace. And aliens visited it as well this past week. There was all these videos of dozens and dozens and dozens of police cars, like probably more police cars than I've ever seen in a single response, like for an incident in Miami or anywhere else for that matter. And they said it was in response to a group of kids who were lighting fireworks and off and shooting them at people in addition to looting stores. But I don't see any videos and haven't been able to find any videos of said incident besides the videos shown of the police response. And if you look at some of them, there's like a figure that people are saying is like an 8 to 10 foot alien walking around Bayside Marketplace. So the internet went with it.
Yeah, as the internet does. And look, I'm very prone to believe the alien theories, of course. And I will say, we were, before we started taping today, I was like looking at the video over and over, and it does look like this figure, it's not a very good video because it's from above, but it does look like the figure is pretty big in comparison to what a regular human would look like next to like police cars. But police are saying, no, we were there with more cops than I think we even have in the state of Washington at one mall for some unruly kids, which I don't know. All I'm saying, put the video out, let the internet decide for itself. All right, Miranda, thank you so much. And I like your very blonder do. Good for you.
Thank you. It's almost summertime in Miami, so I'm just trying to go with the flow.
It's always summertime in Miami. All right, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Meow. Not even controversial anymore. All right, before we get to questions and comments from the live stream, as well as our daily subscriber show poll, speaking of Donald Trump, that's what the poll was about today. Every Thursday, we talk to our friend Zach Abraham from Bulwark Capital. If you watch the show and you aren't an absolute expert by now on the real estate market and on stocks and retirement portfolios, I don't know how else to help you. So Zach Abraham and I talked about, 2024, presidential election year, the economy is showing signs of weakness, regardless of what those in power might seem to suggest. So we talked about preparing for the worst in an unpredictable economy, while also still looking to improve your outlook for retirement. From your perspective, your job is to manage risk, right? So are you always looking at things through a lens of pessimism?
Yes and no. I think that if you're going to be a good investor, it is very hard to be a good investor and to be a pessimist. Just because, right, it's how we, if you short the stock market and the market goes down 60%, good, you made 60%. But, if the market can only go down 100%, right? Hmm. And it can go up over this last run, over the last, 4 or 5 years, or excuse me, last 15 years, market's gone up, 350, 380% or something like that. So, but what you do look at is you do look at risk reward, where when I go into this year and I'm looking at stocks at these levels with all of these issues that they have, you do the math on it, right? I can go buy a risk-free U.S. government bond trading me around 4.5%. Okay. I flip around. I go look at a company like Microsoft trading at 1.9% earnings yield. Okay. I could be wrong, but 100 times out of 100, if you give me the choice to buy a company like Microsoft at a 1.9 earnings yield or get a 5% risk-free guaranteed bond from the Treasury, I'm taking the bond every time. Does it mean that I'm going to be right 100% of the time? No. But it does mean I'll probably be right 85 to 90% of the time.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just risk-reward, right? If I'm looking at a bond paying me 3 and Microsoft sitting at a 5.6% earnings yield, okay, now we're talking, right? There's a reason to go out on that. And that's the issue you have when I look at this market. just the risks to the downside. It just doesn't. If you're going to give me a risk-free 5%, it's hard to pass up until stock prices. Now there are parts of the market. I think they're the energy market or energy slices, energy companies. There are parts that are very attractive, but they're attractive because nobody wants them. So, you know, I think there are opportunities there. But as a risk manager, you just look at this scenario and you're like, boy, a lot of bad things can happen from markets at these levels. Just not a lot of good things can.
Yeah, there's time to take risks. There are times certainly not to take risks. In 2024, there are a lot of, gosh, landmines in the road with the presidential election. So especially if you're close to retirement, managing risk is so important. Zach talks about these things on his radio show, knowyourriskradio.com. Knowyourriskradio.com. You can also learn about Bulwark Capital Management's risk management strategy. In fact, they have a webinar upcoming that we'll talk about next week. Okay, let's get to first the daily subscriber show poll, because I don't know if you saw there was a, we didn't even talk about it on the show today. That's how little I care right now. There was a debate between Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis. Chris Christie dropped out of the presidential race. And then did you see he was caught on a hot mic talking crap about Nikki Haley, saying she's like going to crash and burn?
I did.
Salty. Mm-hmm. I love how the guy who failed harder like wants to talk about how someone who's beating him, like doing better than him, is going to fail. It's like, okay, compensating they, much. He might be right, but at the same time, like, you got no support. You were basically the Jay Inslee of this era, of this round.
You know, a lot of times I feel like the you know, the bickering is kind of just part of the gig, yeah. But it really seems that the other candidates don't like her.
Yeah, it's super petty. Yeah. Okay, but Donald Trump, at the same time, because he's not participating in the GOP debates, he was on a town hall at Fox News, and he suggested that he has chosen who his running mate would be. Now, whether he's told that person, I don't know. But I asked you guys on Patreon and Locals this morning, former President Donald Trump indicated in a Fox News town hall that he's decided who his 2024 running mate would be, putting aside your personal feelings about the former president. That's critical. Who do you believe would be the best choice out of those listed? Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis, Vivek Ramaswamy, or Tulsi Gabbard? And that's not to say that his choice is even on the list.
Right. I actually think it's his son.
Well, oh my gosh, I hope not. I'm curious if you guys have any other ideas. Right now, most people are saying Tulsi Gabbard, between Tulsi Gabbard and Nikki Haley, which I don't even know if these people would do it. I just picked four names I think would be interesting. Mm-hmm. And things have soured so much between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. Very few people in our poll are saying Ron DeSantis. And we've talked about this. I actually agree with that because they're so similar. The goal is with a running mate to bring other people in, to attract other people with that running mate. I don't see how you do it with Ron DeSantis. David Sprinkle says, I think Ron and Don would clash. I would love to see DeSantis rehab his image and resume in Florida, then try again in 2028. Derek says, Nikki Haley, speaking of people who dislike Nikki, Derek Washington says, Nikki Haley is completely awful. She can't make up her mind about anything. She's ready to send more money to Ukraine, can't decide what the retirement age should be, says she's inspired by Hillary Clinton, then turned around and said she didn't say that. I could go on and on and on. Jennifer says, Vivek. Man, I don't see how Vivek would bring anyone else into it, though. I
don't think it's going to be one of the other.
I like a lot of the stuff he says. Like, he took the media to task the other day on their questions that are just designed to elicit a specific response, and I love some of that stuff. But I think it has the same issue Ron DeSantis does, which I don't believe he brings anyone else into the equation. And if you're not choosing someone who can win over independents, then you're failing 100%. Jeff Roy M. says, I'm torn between Nikki and Tulsi. Frankly, I like what Tulsi has to say a bit more, but I like her chances for the future to be a true voice of reason, and I don't want to see or ruin those chances by being tied too closely to Trump. I think that's a fair assertion. Let's see what they're saying over on Locals. Sometimes on Locals, far more people right now are saying Nikki Haley. Chris Mann 2 says, Tulsi is a true contender, bright, experienced, no holds barred, and a vet. Check her profile out. She's truly amazing. The fact that she's smart enough to leave the Democrat zoo and become a sane Republican is truly inspiring. What was I going to say?
I think it might be more along the lines of a Sarah Huckabee Sanders, because she's endorsed him already for next year.
That's not bad.
And, or I guess I have seen some chatter about there's some Republican woman in New York, a representative, I think, and she's a 39-year-old Republican woman, and I think that could...
I think a woman is important. because, you know, one of the like knocks that you continually go after Trump for is like they feel like he's is past treatment of women, you know, the grab him by the you know what and all of that stuff. But this is all conjecture. We're just having fun here.
I know. Right? We're just having fun.
I like it though. I like some of your guesses.
I'm going to keep this audio and bring it back up when he announces.
Yeah, I don't know about Sarah Huckabee Sanders. That would be quite a, I mean, from the press secretary to a governor to a vice president. A little nepotism going on there. I'm
think
not sure about that.
So much. There's so many people that have not stayed silent on Trump or not supported him, and he can't go for any of those. So it's pretty hard to find somebody that spoke good about Trump within that candidate range.
I've heard Kerry Lake, but I don't think he picked that. Again, is somebody divisive. That's too absolutely too divisive and too close to him. We'll see. Keep your guesses coming. Let's see. All questions and comments from the live stream. On what?
Oh. I'm just going to leave me on then.
Yeah, we're going right into comments. Please do. Mm-hmm. On the gender ideology book, Liz said school districts are afraid of being sued for discrimination. Look, fine, but you accept the teacher. You don't have to force it on fourth graders. And hopefully a functioning adult would understand that. Mm-hmm. Hopefully Miss Angela turned to Mr. Angel would understand if they are a reasonable adult. That, hey, I can't expect every fourth grader in my class and all their parents to be okay with this. And I'm just going to just live with whatever these little kids call me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Maybe don't do this in the middle of the school year.
Right.
Maybe wait the other thing too. Till the summer.
Y says, so no one in charge of education is willing to stand up to defend our children. How disappointing and disgusting. We can't afford a private school. My kids will not learn well from me. The only option left, if this goes on, is for us to leave the state as soon as we are able to. And that is so deeply disappointing. But you point out something that's just true. It's hard for a lot of parents to have an option that is not our public school system. Mm-hmm. That's why we have to fight to improve it. That's why it's important for parents to speak up. It's important for taxpayers who fund these schools to speak up. It's important for grandparents to speak up. It's important for siblings, everybody. Because for a lot of parents, there's no way out of the public school system. No plausible way out. Either you got to be rich or you got to be a stay-at-home parent or whatever it is.
Right.
And I also think that's, you know, bringing up the conversation of charter schools and allowing parents to make that decision that, hey, a charter school specifically tailored to my child's style of learning or whatever it is or ambitions is better suited, and having the government help with that. To me, I just don't know how, if you really are in it for the best interests of kids, and there are kids who would do so much better in a charter school setting, you're really only against that as Democrats because the teachers union. Right. Mm-hmm. And because of the money coming in. And if you start lose, you know, that's what it's all about. So for you, it's about money. It's about money being a slave to the teachers union. And it's not about the education of kids, because we would not be OK with these outcomes if it were about the education of kids. All right, Nicole.
Let's see. Where are we? Let's
Greg.
See. Greg. Polls mean nothing, especially in the state with mail-in voting. The big story to cover is the lack of accountability in mail-in voting. And I know
he says, I know you know it's true.
It's been this way since Greg Bohr versus Rossi.
Look, Gregory.
Here we go.
That was a long time ago.
What have we done to make sure that it doesn't happen again?
We've talked about this on the show, adding the redundancy, allowing people to track their ballots. I'm not saying it's perfect. The biggest issue with mail-in voting is the chain of custody. And we saw this with the examples of ballots that got left in USPS mailboxes. So you're taking this government entity that's not involved in elections and you're making them responsible for the delivery of ballots, et cetera. So I get it. I understand. I like mail-in voting. What bothers me is when, you know, one side wants to act like there's no improvements that can be made. We can't possibly do anything to make it any better. And the other side wants to act like somebody's taking my ballot out of the drop box and changing my vote. There's a lot of gray area between those things. I think it's unfair to compare our current system to the stolen Rossi campaign.
That's fair. I think it's just an example. He's saying there are...
Sorry, Greg.
There is something in the past that makes him nervous about it. But
Greg,
also,
it's not you, it's me. Okay, I'm not... That's not anger directed
also,
at you.
Also, I'm going to just bring up the chicken checks. Like, too many dead people, too many people that are in the wrong county, wrong state now, whatever. We need a better record system of... who gets to vote and where they're voting from.
And no desire to fix that. no desire from the AG's office to take accountability for that rollout of those checks.
Right.
And just to, and so that is also another thing that worries me, where, okay, if you do have an identifiable problem with the voting system, like, are you going to be willing to really take a genuine look at it? And I know Steve Hobbs is not Bob Ferguson. There are many different kinds of Democrats, and I think I trust Steve Hobbs far more than I trust Bob Ferguson and his ability to look at something internally. But Steve Hobbs also didn't speak out and hasn't yet about the attacks on the initiative process. Yep. That's really disappointing to me, because I'm led to believe he's this very moderate Democrat, you know, kind of similar to Mark Mullett, who I think is really reasonable. But come on, man, if it were Republicans, why would you not speak out about it? I have to believe it's only political, and I don't particularly appreciate it. Mm. Ow, almost broke a nail there.
I'm
on...
just all about the grunting today. Everything's making me...
on the polling, Andy Stevens says Jim Walsh is the best thing we have going for the party. I'm assuming you mean the Washington State Republican Party, obviously. And look, I mean, Jim Walsh has a tough task ahead. This divisive behavior from, like, the Semi Byrd campaign and a lot of his supporters, where it's like, even with me, is there any member of the media who has been, when they were mainstream, more fair to Republicans in this state than I have been?
No, I think, like, when I was with Fox, extremely fair, yeah.
And yet it's like, you don't like one candidate they like, and it's like, oh, you're an enemy. And it's like, okay, no, I've articulated the reasons I'm supporting Dave Ryker. I, you know, believe that he can actually win. I believe he has the experience to do it, the public safety bona fides to do it. But on top of that, I've said, the moment I knew I wouldn't support Semi Byrd is when I listened to the 911 calls of him calling police departments out where he lives, talking about how much his home is worth, how much his car is worth, really talking down to the 911 dispatcher. That was a personality issue for me. The second I heard those 911 calls, I knew that that's not somebody I would vote for. So the idea that I could have this whole track record of being fair to Republicans and trying to let people know the danger of one-party rule, and then because I don't like a school board, a recalled school board member who's running for governor, that I'm like all of a sudden the worst person in the world. I get that all the time on my social media. It's like, well, come on, grow up.
That's the social media trolls.
But it's similar to Lauren Culp's campaign. It's the exact same thing I experienced from Lauren Culp's campaign.
It is.
After I dared, like, even I was in mainstream media at the time, and I would ask him legitimate questions, and it's like, oh, you can't do that. That's not fair. It's like, no, I'm being hard on Inslee, and I'm going to be hard on Lauren Culp.
Right.
That's my job. And we've been hard on Dave Ryker.
Right.
We have talked about the fact that Dave Ryker needs to get a little pep in his step.
Right.
He needs to be out there more on social media. Not that social media wins elections. But Semi Byrd is doing a much better job of social media. He's doing a much better job at getting his supporters involved in the process, et cetera, and traveling around the state to areas where Republicans aren't usually at.
Right.
So I acknowledge all that. But don't come at me on social media because I don't like a candidate that you like.
But back to...
I haven't been rude about it, so don't be rude about it to me.
Back to the comment, which
was
Jim Walsh. He's a good guy.
Oh, wow. Oh, gosh. Yeah, sorry.
I think that Jim Walsh has a really hard task at hand, which you mentioned, but it's a tough thing to be in charge of something like that, I think, because you're dealing with adults. You don't want to treat them as children. And, like, you're not the boss.
Right.
You're just encouraging people, and then you get in trouble. I mean, Semi came on here and complained about people encouraging him to do things. That's all you can do is encourage people.
Yeah.
And not be offended by it. And it's a tough job.
And
bringing a party together.
I don't mean to get on the thing about this, but I'm not a Republican. I'm not a member of the Republican Party. To that end, what they do is their business. And if Semi Byrd as a candidate doesn't want to drop out, or Dave Ryker doesn't want to drop out because they don't want to sign some non-binding agreement, fine. That's their decision. But I think we have to live with the consequences, which is a Bob Ferguson governorship. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. And that is just about as serious a consequence for the state of Washington as I can dream up. So all the pettiness and the attacking and the infighting, that's what it's at the expense of, is the state that we all love and care about. Because Bob Ferguson will absolutely win if you cannot get your shit together.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Sorry. You know, I'm going to go broke. I'm going to go broke with the swear jar this year.
Well, you need to decide on a charity this year, so.
Oh, that's right.
Get that together.
Also, get your, if you're a subscriber on Patreon or Locals, get your nominations in for our charity of the year. Okay, on the moon. Oh my gosh. Oh, well, first I'll fit Julie Bailey in on Massachusetts and what's happening with them asking citizens to house migrants. Julie Bailey says, we are approaching another civil war with the division of this country. It is crazy. Socialism on the rise. I mean, things are wild right now. I'm not going quite into the civil war camp, but as you know, every day I get more red-pilled. Every day I get closer and closer to saying things that will get me deplatformed. On the moon. The moon thing. Apparently we have a lot of moon deniers listening to the show today. Mandy goes, go Nicole, the camera guy was the first guy on the moon. Shirley Lopez, there's no reason to go to the moon anymore. Huge waste of resources. Matt Gilbert says, oh, you are one of those people who believe in the moon. Wake up, sheeple. On my maybe bikini pic, who knows? Vicky Berg, you go, girl. Take it from a 70-year-old. Vicky, you're 70? I've seen a picture. I've seen you. I've met you. You don't look 70. Dang, right. Girl. I need to be whatever's Vicky's on. Take it from a 70-year-old. Be strong. Being strong and fit is awesome, but no bikini photo for me. Ain't no one want to see that.
I mean, people might, but that doesn't mean, you know.
You know, look.
You want to give it to them.
I just, things come into my head, and I just say them out loud.
I know. So, and by the way, we just got a super chat, $5 from Sally. Swear jar.
For my swear jar. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we, Nicole? Thank you very much. I didn't even toss to our sanity check
yesterday.
So let us get to our closing sanity check. If you don't buy an electric vehicle, you're just an evil person. You're just not a good person. You hate the environment. You hate our planet. You hate Jay Inslee. You hate our children. You want them to cough on dirty air and not have a planet to live on in 50 years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And after all, Pete Buttigieg said, hey, you know, if gas prices are too high, you just go buy one of those EVs. Well, EVs aren't working out very well. You might recall, and I actually have a personal story about this, because two guests at my wedding took EVs out to our wedding in Cle Elum. One of them was Jason Rands.
Rentals.
Yeah, they took rentals. Mm-hmm. They got rentals at the airport to drive out to Cle Elum. This is two separate people. They both had Teslas, I think.
Yep.
And they both ran out of power.
Yep.
They both ran out of power. Jason Rance was almost late to my wedding because his EV ran out of power. But the thing is that a lot of these car rental companies were given incentives to have more electric vehicles on their fleet. Well, it turns out nobody wants to rent them. So now what are they doing? They're getting rid of them and getting more gas-powered vehicles. This is from Fox News. Hertz selling 20,000 EVs from fleet to reinvest in gas-powered vehicles. Look, I am the first person who's going to line up when electric vehicles are actually useful for people who are needing them for other things besides going three blocks in the city. I will be the first one there when they are affordable enough and competitive enough in that way. But I am not going to get stranded on the side of the road. And it turns out a lot of rental car customers don't want to either. That has been your sanity check for today. A reminder, in your inbox on Patreon and Locals tomorrow, you will find a legislative show that we're going to begin tomorrow that is going to, for the first time ever, no opinion. It was funny. We were working on, I was taping an interview. Our first guest is going to be Senator Mark Mullett on some bills he's got. And I was laughing at him before we started. I was like, this isn't an opinion show. And it's going to be very hard for me to shove down my opinion on things. But you guys hear my opinion enough during the week. Really what the goal of this is to make sure that we don't have these vacant spaces when it comes to what's happening in Olympia. There are too few reporters covering the issue. And I know that you can't watch every hearing, be tracking every bill, et cetera. And so we want to make sure you have a nice little package at the end of the week that talks about, yes, some of the things we discuss on the show, but also gives you a look at everything that happened at Olympia this week. We'll do it every single week of the legislative session. So I hope you enjoy that added offering. That has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you'd like to support our show in this critical election year during this important legislative session, you can sign up for just $5 a month at undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. We will see subscribers on the Sunday show.